It's the NPR News Update podcast, full of Minnesota news for Wednesday, December 17th. I'm Phil Picardi with news about the resignation of the Minneapolis school superintendent, the final draft of Rochester's Destination Medical Center, a new Muslim worship center in the Twin Cities, dropping oil prices and possible losses for companies invested in North Dakota, and Minnesota's new House Speaker. First, the Twin Cities International Airport is set for an $18 million renovation to speed security lines. Tim Nelson has more.
The airport will start construction in April. The plan calls for three existing checkpoints to be closed, and a new 10-lane checkpoint will be built at the east end of the ticketing lobby. Airport spokesman Pat Hogan says the changes will reduce waits.
You go through the full body scanner, your bags go through. We're going to have facilities there where you can take your belongings and have a comfortable place to sit down with tables and chairs to put on your shoes and belt and coat and put your belongings back in your carry-on so that you don't slow down the process for other people whose bags are trying to get through the screening machine.
The changes will leave two big checkpoints on either end of the main ticketing lobby. The project is scheduled to be finished in 2016. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Metropolitan Airports Commission is requiring airline subcontractors at MSP to provide workers paid sick leave. Matt Sepik reports.
Starting January 1st, companies that employ workers including wheelchair assistants, cart drivers, and cabin cleaners must give their employees an hour of paid sick time for every 30 hours they work. Airport spokesman Patrick Hogan says the policy also provides some job security.
If they lose the contract to another contractor, the new contractor has to keep those employees on for at least 90 days.
The decision from the Metropolitan Airports Commission follows a protest a week and a half ago by the Service Employees International Union that temporarily blocked vehicle traffic to MSP's Terminal 1. Hogan says the policy is not expected to result in additional costs to travelers. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Delta Airlines claims it has fixed a flaw in its mobile boarding pass system that allowed sharing without a login. Peter Cox reports.
A passenger discovered that she could share her boarding pass easily by sending a URL which could be opened without a login. The passenger, Danny Grant, was interviewed for a web story posted on Mashable.com. In the story, Grant said she was able to access other customers' boarding passes by changing digits in the URL for her own boarding pass. In a statement, a Delta spokesperson said IT teams have installed a solution to the problem. He said the Atlanta-based airline is not aware of any compromised customer accounts or threats to safety. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Fairview Health Services is now asking people with flu-like symptoms and young children not to visit patients in the chain's hospitals. Mark Zedeklik reports.
The Minnesota Department of Health recently declared flu widespread in Minnesota. Fairview Health Services Director of Patient Safety Steve Mizell says Fairview is screening visitors for flu symptoms and prohibiting most children under five from seeing patients.
People who are in the hospital are sick. And if they were to come down with the flu on top of their underlying illness, that could really set back their recovery.
Fairview says the policy is temporary and that it is willing to make case-by-case exceptions for compassion reasons. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Duluth City Council has passed a resolution asking for a change in state law to allow for the free sharing of seeds. Dan Crocker explains.
This fall, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture told the Duluth Public Library that its seed library was violating the state's seed law. The library allows members to borrow vegetable seeds in the spring and later return seeds they collect from their gardens. But Minnesota law requires seeds to be labeled and tested for germination before they're sold or even given away. Duluth biology teacher Michael Gabler told the city council that sharing seeds is especially important in Duluth's climate.
You keep the ones that produce really well, and you end up with plants that are hardy to our region.
The Duluth council passed the resolution unanimously. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Minneapolis school superintendent Bernadia Johnson is stepping down from that position at the end of January. The Minneapolis School Board accepted Johnson's resignation at its meeting last night. In a statement, Johnson says she is leaving because family commitments have become increasingly challenging. She has been the superintendent for 4 years. Education reporter Tim Post joined Kathy Werzer this morning.
She's been under criticism. The school board's been critical of the district's inability to close this widening achievement gap between white students and students of color. because of that. Do you think she was forced out?
The board members I talked to last night said we did not ask for her resignation. But you're right, they have become increasingly frustrated with this gap in student achievement. She is also very frustrated with this. When I talked to her in the fall, she was very upset about the latest round of test scores and wasn't ready to throw her hands in the air, she said, but she knew that the district needed to do something to turn around this achievement gap. The school board members I talked to said it's possible that that frustration on her behalf may have led to her resigning at this time.
What are the other challenges that the district is facing?
The achievement gap, for sure, that's going to continue to be a challenge for the district. And they've put a new plan in place to try to raise the achievement of all students, particularly students of color, by 2020. That is a big goal. The other challenge, of course, is enrollment. The district has seen a steady decrease in enrollment in recent years, a lot of families choosing to enroll their students outside of the district or in charter schools in Minneapolis.
She's been in the job 4 years. What has Bernadia Johnson accomplished in that time?
Her latest accomplishment, I guess we could call it, is a decrease in the number of suspensions in the district. This year, she called for a ban on suspension for the district's youngest students, kindergartners, first graders. She also put in place this fall an effort to review every suspension of Hispanic students, Native American students, and Black students to see why they were suspended and how to decrease those suspensions in the future.
I want to circle back to reaction. You talked to school board members. Have you heard of any reaction from rank-and-file teachers or teachers' union officials?
Well, my colleague Nancy Liebens last night talked with the president of the teachers' union, Lynn Norgren, and she was surprised at the announcement, but she said that teachers have been working well with the person who's going to take over for Superintendent Johnson in the interim, and they look forward to working with him.
Now, who is that person?
That is Michael Gore. He's the district's CEO. He'll take over for Johnson when she leaves in January. He's been with the district for about a year now.
What's his background?
Well, he's a graduate of Washburn High School, so he's from the Minneapolis School District. He's worked in the Minneapolis School District before. He has worked in the Boston School District. A few years ago, he returned to Minnesota to take over at Generation Next, a group that was started to try to close the achievement gap. And that's a group now that is led by former Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback. So he'll take over in late January as the board begins to meet and discuss and to figure out who will be the next superintendent.
Will there be a nationwide search?
I'm guessing so. I'm sure they'll look at superintendents in large urban districts to possibly find someone who has struggled, a place where they have struggled with the achievement gap and maybe made some improvements.
Well, I know what your assignment's going to be today, so thank you so much for coming in early and doing this live update.
You're welcome.
Tim Post and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. If all goes as planned, Twin Cities Muslim leaders will soon be able to hold prayer services in the basement of a suburban office center. And that's no small thing. A settlement agreement ends a federal lawsuit alleging the city of St. Anthony Village violated federal law when it rejected a proposal for an Islamic center 2 years ago. Leaders from the city, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the Somali American community say it's time to heal and move on. Laura Ewan reports.
Dozens of Somali American leaders, including local imams, stood shivering but united with their former adversary, the mayor of St. Anthony. They all gathered in front of the imposing mid-century office building that was the center of the two-year-old dispute. One of the imams, Sheikh Abdurrahman Omar, offered an olive branch to residents of this small suburb who opposed the mosque proposal.
We understand that you may have some fear of Somali people and Muslims, but I want to tell you, we came here 20 years ago seeking freedom and safety. The same reason is you forefathers come here.
It was Omar's way of reaching out to even those residents who spewed hateful comments at a public meeting in 2012. The city council had denied a conditional use permit for the Abu Huraira Islamic Center, going against a recommendation from the Planning Commission. City leaders said the decision wasn't discriminatory. They just said the plans for the mosque weren't compatible with the area's light industrial zoning. Mayor Jerry Faust, who voted against the Senate proposal, now offered conciliatory words, although the agreement still needs approval by the city council. He says it felt good to reach a compromise.
And I couldn't find a better time of the year to do that than at this time. Not because it's cold, but because it's the time of peace and goodwill to people, and we need to do the right thing.
U.S. Attorney Andrew Luger sued the city in August, alleging that the city council was unlawfully biased against a religious use because the light industrial district where the site is located allowed secular groups to assemble. Luger says the settlement reverses what he calls an injustice.
Today marks a new beginning for the Somali community and the people of St. Anthony. It is a proud day for all Minnesotans.
Hassan Mahmoud, the imam of a mosque in St. Paul, says the resolution gives him hope that the U.S. Attorney's Office will investigate other perceived forms of injustice toward Muslims. Mahmoud says he's one of many Somali Americans who continue to face extra security screening while traveling at the airport. He says the announcement about the mosque is a positive first step.
It's the beginning of the long journey that Somalis in particular, but all Muslims will feel that we are part of the American fabric.
But until last week, some weren't convinced that the city and the mosque could settle their differences. Nikki Carlson, a lobbyist for the Islamic Center, says she thought a trial was all but inevitable. A marathon hearing Thursday before Magistrate Judge Jeffrey Keyes lasted about 12 hours. Carlson remembers that while waiting to hear the developments, the imams prayed four times as part of their religious duty.
It was so funny because they would pray, and then the judge would come back and give us good news. And then they'd pray, and then the judge would come back and give us good news.
Mayor Jerry Faust says there was never a turning point that convinced him to settle, but he says he was aware that if the case went to trial, the city could have lost.
So sometimes you just need to take a look at it and say, what is best for the community? How do we move forward? How do we commence the healing? And how do we make it better for all parties involved to the best of our ability.
Another imam, Sheikh Ahmed Barali, thanked Faust for working with the community. Barali spoke through a Somali translator.
And also we ask folks to forgive one another. No hard feelings, no hardships.
No hard feelings.
Thank you.
No hard feelings. None whatsoever. We are all brothers.
All right. Good.
With that, the mayor shook the imam's hand and said, "You will be accepted by this community." Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Anthony.
Planners of Minnesota's largest economic development project unveil a final draft today of a plan that transforms downtown Rochester into a global medical destination. The nearly $6 billion project will change the Rochester skyline to support Mayo Clinic's aggressive expansion. As officials move closer toward a crucial vote on the plan early next year, Elizabeth Baer gives us a glimpse of the proposed designs.
Here are a few images from the new design for downtown Rochester. In front of Mayo's tallest building, the 20-floor Gonda building, instead of a quiet pedestrian walkway, an ice skating rink. A few blocks away, the city's main plaza would be covered with a towering light pavilion. And down the road, the Zumbro River, which is now a concrete channel aimed at flood prevention, would see a permanent farmer's market along the waterfront.
The change for this community is only going to enhance the experience for our patients and those of us who live here.
Lisa Clark is executive director of Rochester's Economic Development Agency. That's the private group that's been working for months on a plan that envisions a much more urban, walkable, and commercial center for downtown Rochester. The plan proposes a dramatic transformation of the city's core and highlights six unique development regions, including an amphitheater and market along the river, a transit hub with access to future light rail connections from the Twin Cities, and a busy commercial and retail space in what master planner Peter Cavaluzzi calls the heart of the city. Cavaluzzi says Rochester is in a competition to attract the best talent, and the city must leverage Mayo's brand to grow its economy.
That new best and brightest generation, they want to live in authentic urban places where they can live in the downtown, they can walk to work, they can take transit, they can be on a bike path, they can go to a waterfront, they can go to a farmer's market.
Cavaluzzi says, based on public comments so far, development of the waterfront is the most popular feature in the plan.
All great cities have tremendous waterfronts and they're wonderful attractions, and Rochester really needs to include that in their array of places and spaces that they offer visitors and residents in their downtown.
Rochester Mayor Ardell Brady sits on both the Destination Medical Center Project's board and the city council. He says for him, transit is the priority.
If we just build a big building and we have no place to park cars or have people to come in, then we're kind of shortchanging ourselves. We better get that transit thing kind of taken care of first. That's my opinion. So I think we really do need to get that part done before we start thinking about grand staircases and all that sort of stuff.
Last year, the state legislature approved $455 million in taxpayer funding to help support Mayo's expansion and add tens of thousands of new jobs to the region over the next 20 years. Most of that aid is to fund improvements to public facilities in the city, things like parking ramps, sidewalks, and roads. According to a draft release last month, some of the plan's big-ticket items include nearly $1.4 billion for public infrastructure and another $557 million for transit and transportation over 20 years. But the development agency's Lisa Clark says the plan will be implemented in five-year phases, and by law, all aspects of the plan, from financing to marketing and operations, will also be assessed every 5 years. The plan her team presents now, she says, will evolve over time.
The market changes, and it changes regularly, and I think it would be a disservice to Rochester and to the state of Minnesota if we created a plan for today and for today's environment and today's market and expected it to be the same 20 years from now. It just won't happen.
Planners will try to win over the DMC board members today and clear a key hurdle before the plan enters a 60-day public comment period. The city council has the final vote on the plan in March. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
Prices at the pump continue dropping with the price of crude oil, which has fallen by almost half since the summer. Oil producers are scaling back drilling as a result. Minnesota companies that have done a booming business in the North Dakota oil fields have certainly noticed the drop, but as Matt Sepik reports, so far the effects are mild.
To get oil out of the ground through the long North Dakota winter, you need heat and a lot of it to keep valves, fracking fluid, and workers from freezing. And you need to generate it in a way that won't accidentally ignite the nearby natural gas, blowing everything to smithereens. That's the business opportunity for a company called Thawzall. At its factory in Alexandria, Minnesota, 400 miles east of the oil patch, about 30 workers assemble portable heating equipment that can be hitched to a pickup truck. General Manager David Reller says one Thawzall heat trailer model was designed specifically for oil fields. There's no flame or spark plugs. It uses a diesel engine, electric generator, and a heating element. Reller says it's highly efficient. Even heat from the tailpipe is recaptured and sent out through the machine's huge blower.
This unit will deliver 1,350,000 BTUs at full load. You can touch the exhaust stack on our machine, and you're not going to burn your hand.
Thawzall opened for business in 1996 to provide heat for building contractors who wanted to work through the winter. Housing and commercial construction took a tumble during the Great Recession, but Reller says by 2011, demand from the North Dakota oil fields had Thawzall firing on all cylinders again. Now with crude oil below $60 a barrel, producers are starting to cut production. Raymond James Financial predicts the number of operating rigs in the U.S. could decline by more than 600, or about a third. Reller says he's keeping a close eye on the price of oil, but he expects business to hold up.
The oil companies have a number of permits that they have to exercise their drilling on, or they're going to lose the opportunity. So it isn't going to be an immediate cut in demand. They're always going to need heat, but it may not be at the scale that we've been experiencing in the last few years.
Reller says even if business from the oil fields dips, he's optimistic about the construction industry, which accounts for half of his customers. Minneapolis Federal Reserve economist Rob Grunewald says Minnesota companies most closely involved in the oil business, those in production and exploration, could take a hit in the short term. But Grunewald says cheaper oil means cheaper gasoline, and that's good for consumers and the rest of the economy.
This size of decrease in gasoline
gasoline prices could allow families to spend about another 30 to 40 or even more per month on other goods and services depending on the amount they drive.
And for communities in western North Dakota struggling to keep up with the enormous population and industrial growth they've seen in recent years, Grunwald says a dip in production might offer them an opportunity to catch their breath and make much-needed investments in housing, transportation, and public services. That's the opportunity Ted Schmid sees. Schmid is Chief Operating Officer at Lumber One, a home builder based in Avon, Minnesota. After the housing bust, Schmid's company found work in the oil patch. He says there's so much pent-up demand for homes in western North Dakota that swings in the price of crude don't keep him up at night. Schmid says he's had more inquiries about apartment projects in the last month than he's had all year.
I think the big picture with apartment construction is you're looking at what's the viability over the next 30 years, not the viability over the next 30 days. And what's happening with the fuel prices is a temporary thing.
And analysts at Raymond James Financial project this downturn in oil prices will be relatively brief, especially when compared to the 20-year bear market for black gold that started in the mid-80s. Their theory is that production cutbacks will reduce excess capacity, leading to a rebound in oil prices and production in 2017. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
When he takes control of the Minnesota House next month, Republican Kurt Dowd will be one of the youngest and least experienced lawmakers to be Speaker of the House. Dowd is 41 years old and will have served only 4 years in the House. As he prepares to negotiate a budget with the DFL Senate and Governor Mark Dayton, also a Democrat, his biggest challenge may be managing the expectations of his fellow Republicans. Catherine Richard has more.
Weeks before he's sworn in, Kurt Dowd is being somewhat vague on the details of what he hopes Republicans will accomplish in the coming legislative session. But what is clear is that Dowd doesn't want a confrontation like the one the last time Minnesota had divided government. 4 years ago, DFL Governor Mark Dayton and Republican lawmakers' fight over the state budget led to a government shutdown. Dowd says he plans to use his relative youth and inexperience to lead an old institution with a fresh approach.
I'm not bound by the history of this place. I'm somebody that I think has a good reputation around here of being willing to think outside the box, being willing to work with anybody.
Legislators always pay lip service to finding common ground, but those who know Dowd say he means it. Dowd is from Crown, just north of the Twin Cities, and before running for the legislature, he worked at a car dealership and served on township and county boards. Dowd says those jobs taught him to listen to people and also shaped his views on the political process. Isanti County Commissioner Susan Morris worked with Dowd on the county board in the mid-2000s. She says Dowd's willingness to build coalitions was apparent during public employee contract negotiations.
I really valued the fact that he didn't, like, dig in his heels and just say, oh, this is the way it's going to be because this is my way or the highway. He doesn't work that way.
After managing Republican Marty Seifert's campaign for governor in 2010, Dowd ran for the House. 2 years later, his colleagues elected him Republican minority leader, and he used that perch to help win 11 legislative seats that secured the House majority for the GOP. But some Republicans aren't so impressed with Dowd. They say his willingness to negotiate is a major problem. Two other Republican representatives challenged Dowd for the speaker's job, and earlier this year, he faced an endorsement challenge in his district in part over concerns that he isn't conservative enough. Minnesota Tea Party Alliance Executive Director Jake Duesenberg shares those concerns. He says Dowd was too quick to compromise with Democrats on a $1 billion public works spending bill.
He's probably not going to be the best guy to fight for the reduction of our government and to repeal the taxes that were passed last 2 years.
For his part, Dowd says the bonding bill he helped negotiate was smaller than previous bills. And Dowd supporters say his conservative credentials are extensive. But the divide over whether Republicans should have come to the table on a bonding bill highlights a simmering intra-party conflict that may emerge during the coming legislative session over issues like taxes and transportation funding. Marty Seifert says Dowd will be a strong leader. But as a former minority leader himself, Seifert says Dowd's biggest challenge will be members of the Republican caucus.
In May or June of 2015, you are going to have a segment of people who are going to say too much money was spent, there wasn't enough conservative policies put in place, blah, blah, blah. They will not be satisfied regardless of what happens in session.
In some instances, Dowd may find common ground with his DFL counterpart in the Senate, Tom Bach of Cook, who says he has a good relationship with Dowd. Both say they aren't in the mood for a spending spree, even though the state has a $1 billion budget surplus. The question will be whether Republicans will also push for tax cuts, which would cost the state money, but put money back in taxpayers' pockets where Republicans say it belongs. Catherine Richert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's the Minnesota News on a Wednesday. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. Thanks for coming along. Back tomorrow.